Angel, would you be the little angel? And there's a little packet of papers over there on that. And would you pass that around? It's a timeline that I've put together for a little bit of fun. So if what I start talking about gets a little boring, you can start reading a timeline of AA. My sobriety date is August the 10th of 2004. And my undergraduate degree actually is in history with a specialty in India and China. When I was sitting on top of Kennesaw Mountain one time, I wondered, what's on the other side of this thing? You know, it's pretty, you know, what's on the other side here? And so I read a lot about it. I've never been there. Furthest, I guess, I've been is Sao Paulo, Brazil, and that's an interesting town. But I think the main thing here is, why history? You know, what's in it for us? What does this have to do with sobriety? And for me, you hear a lot of times that history is learning from, you know, we learn from our mistakes. I don't know about you, but I didn't learn from my mistakes. I learned from the successes, you know, because certain things I did didn't work, but the ones I learned and the one I try and keep doing are the things that work. So for me, this is why I call it wisdom is learning from success. Now, there's a book by Bill Bryson called A Short History of Nearly Everything. Has anybody read that book or seen it? Wonderful little book. And Bill Bryson in there, he says, you know, I've missed trillions of atoms that have somehow come together into me. You know, how did that happen? And in that thing, he starts exploring all these really neat things. And one of the things he looks at is he looks at this story about the Neanderthals. And there's this cave. And in this cave, they've been digging in this cave down, and they've gone through 40,000 years of layers of history in this cave. And you know what? The tools hardly changed at all in 40,000 years. Now, you know what they didn't have in that cave? Anybody got any suggestions? What did they not have in that cave? Because it became real clear to me. And I'll tell you what they didn't have. They didn't have Homo sapien teenagers. That's right, Homo sapien teenagers. Never satisfied with the way the parents did things, always had to get in rebellion and get off and do something different. And I think this is the real picture of it here for me. You know, what's the difference? One of the great things, you know, we talk, as I have had both my son and my daughter, and they went through high school and all that, which is a terrible, that almost should be a law you don't have to go through like the age 15. You know, that's a really rough one. But to me, it is about the rebellion has its own purpose because we have this urge to do things different, to do things new, to learn, to break out and do it a new way. And I think that's great. And I think there's also about learning from the wisdom of those who have been there before. And I think that we need both. The Neanderthals didn't have that. They had the wisdom of the ancients, but they didn't have the rebellion of the youth that drove us forward. So I think the compromise is more imaged by this, which is, you know, the young person helping out with an older person and learning together here, you know, in an exercise room and just sharing together. Now, I've done one thing for the last 5 years. Once I came in, I started taking care of some elderly people one day a week in their homes. And I have learned so much, and we've shared back and forth together. And what I do is, if there's anything else in here, is seek out the people that have had some experience in AA and talk to them about it, what it was like. And I find out the folks are very accessible and very willing to talk and to learn about things, about what happened. Also, the literature. We have the book Pass It On. Who here has anybody read Pass It On? So Pass It On is the biography. Hey, there we go. But Pass It On is the biography of Bill Wilson, and it was written primarily by a guy named Mel B. And I had a chance to meet Mel down in Macon at the National Archives here in October. And he will break out in song if you give him half a chance. And he's quite a character. But he knew a lot of the people, you know, that he wrote about in the book. And it's really neat to be around people who have, and as I said, very accessible. Don't think these people are not accessible, and you can ask questions and get to know them. It's a wonderful experience. How about Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers? Now this is a great book, because this is one of the early books that somebody gave me. I was probably 30 or 40 days sober, and I started reading this, and I really began to get to where I said, I'd like to be like these. I'd like to get to know these kind of people that were doing this. And let me tell you what, they were searching around in the dark. You talk about in those early days, there was no book, there wasn't any 12 steps. They were groping around in the dark, and that took a lot of courage, you know, to take these ideas that might work, and sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. And what Bill said is, of our traditions, they were hammered out on the anvil of our experience. And how about this one? Alcoholics Anonymous comes of age. All right, now we got a little more. And there's a lot of really good stuff. I just reread this just in preparation for this. And there's a lot of good stuff about all the way AA has been put together in these books. Well, we have Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. And I heard Sister Ignatia do a talk, and she said that they were perfect together. You know, what one of them lacked, the other had. And if you look at that, Bill was the consummate salesman and the promotion guy. And if he had his way, it'd be out and advertised, and people would be on the street corners, and we'd have hospitals and missionaries and everything else. And if Dr. Bob really had his way, he was really quiet, he liked it one-on-one, and we're not sure if it had spread too far from Cleveland, and from Akron and Cleveland. So what I'm going to talk about, though, is I want to also get into some of the nuances you can take these books that I've just talked about, go read them, learn about what AA says about the story of AA and how it came about. But there are some things in these books that we're finding out are a little bit, that the facts of history don't seem to support some of the storyline that we have in some of these books, because we're finding out more about what happened in the past. And here's the most important thing for my own sobriety. My past, as I remember it, didn't happen that way. Anybody, you got brothers or sisters, and you share something together, and you go, don't you remember when we were doing this? And they'd say, no, we weren't there. We were over here. You know, and the crazy part about it is, our resentments are built up on this story we're telling ourselves about our past. And it's ever-changing. Now, I'll tell you what's real about my past right now is my attitudes and my memories about my past, my wife's attitudes and memories about my past, my daughter, my son, all the people around me. And I'll tell you what, my past has changed. My wife and my son, and my kids, my dad look at my past a whole lot differently than they did when it was going on. And that's the neat thing about AA. We can literally change our past by the way we behave and conduct ourselves today. Roland Hazard. Anybody familiar with the name Roland Hazard? Roland Hazard was, he was born into a family of wealth in Rhode Island, and he was quite a drinker. And Roland is the person that is begins a chain of events that leads down to Bill Wilson. And here's how it works. Roland Hazard was having a lot of drinking problems. He was also, as it turns out, based on a paper I just found, he was also having marriage problems. So in the books talk about 1931, but there's no proof of that, about him going to see Dr. Carl Jung. What we have found out in this little paper that I found, I actually paid $12 to download this thing, and what we found out is he was actually there in 1926, and he was there for about 3 months rather than a full year. Maybe he was really there from May to September, but what happened is Roland was there. He got to talking with Carl Jung, but his wife was out partying in Paris and everything, and she finally came back, and Carl Jung started talking with his wife, and then Roland says afterwards, he didn't talk to me very much after that. He got so busy trying to fix his wife. So, and Bill tells the story that Roland Hazard was with Carl Jung for a full year, and that was the source, and that's how he got sober, and then he came into the Oxford group, which we'll talk about later. Carl Jung is the great psychologist of the 20th century. There were three, really, Freud, Adler, and Jung. And the difference between Jung was Jung looked at a spiritual side and recognized a spiritual side of life. And he was also one who did field research. Carl Jung went to Africa. He went to different places. What he looked at was, in different cultures around the world, what was mental health? What was normal behavior? And what also, what kind of things did they do? The medicine men, the different doctors and around different cultures, what did they do to help heal the people? And he came up with several concepts you may recognize. Anybody ever heard the word persona? And it really, he got that from the masks that the hunters would wear after the hunt. And, you know, you'd put on the mask of the lightning god and be the lightning god. You'd put on the mask of the mountain or the mask of the hunted beast and you'd become that. And Carl Jung asked us a question. For us, aren't we like that? You're at work, you put on the mask of the worker. I remember going into the bank. I like to walk into the bank, and there's this, and the teller is there, and she's got her teller mask on, and she's and I look, and she has this brooch on, and it's a butterfly, and I look at the brooch, and I go, that's a beautiful brooch, and her mask just comes down, and she goes, that's a very special brooch to me. I said, how so? She said, well, I just changed careers and moved from Florida, and my best friend gave this to me before I left. It's a sign of metamorphosis. I said, oh, I understand metamorphosis. You know, oh, yes, I do. And don't we all? See, and this is what, and this is part of what, and I knew that. I see the mask. And once you understand where this is coming from, why is Carl Jung so well suited for us? Because it says the alcoholic leads a double life. You know, I got pleasure by sneaking around. What about you? You know, and what I find out this program does is it removes all of those little stories I tell myself about who I should be, and I begin to connect that with actually who I am, and I become perfectly all right with who I am. That's one of the things I learned from reading about Carl Jung. Carl Jung also told us the difference between religion and spirituality. He said, it's dogma. Religion says, if you believe this, you're one of us. If you don't, you're not. Spirituality says, don't care what you believe. We're all interconnected in some way. There's something else going on, some power we need to connect up with. Whatever your conception of it, it's fine by me. Now, Rowan Hazard, this was in 1929, actually. 1929, he and his wife get divorced. But he also winds up going in September of that 26th. On September 26th, he goes to Africa on a safari. And now there's letters back around December or January because Roland is sick, okay? Which probably means drunk because the letters from his family, his first cousins, are saying, this one first cousin or the other, you got to go over to Africa and get him. And this is from Rhode Island. So he actually had one of his cousins have to go to Africa to get him off a drunk. Now that's going to any length for a family member. That's maybe the start of Al-Anon was really there, right? But that's what this also was talking about, these undiscovered letters from Rowland Hazard. And I'm going to read what Rowland, this is what's amazing, because I'd never read Rowland Hazard's talk, you know, and what he said. And these are his words. This is a letter. It says, Dear Leonard, that's the first cousin, who actually was the one later on when he got him in Africa. After various fussiness and social necessities had been attended to in London, Paris, and Brussels, we arrived here May the 6th, which is in Zurich, Switzerland. We are most comfortably established in this hotel, as you said. You know, it's as good as you said. It has rained 5 days of the nine, and we've been here, but nevertheless, I've had a lot of hand tennis, some fine walks, and some golf. He was evidently quite an active guy. Tony Wolfe, who was someone who was working with Carl Jung, saw us both on the 7th, and since then, I've had an hour with Dr. Jung every day except holidays. I think we get along splendidly. The first day he saw me, Jung asked for dreams. That night, I dreamed three corkers. He read them and remarked, these are fine, fine, but for God's sakes, don't dream anymore. We've been at work interpreting them, and it all seems most fascinating and logical to me. So that was the kind of treatment that Carl Jung and he were going through. And it was a lot of dream therapy because he learned from Freud, and Freud was all about dream therapy. This is a picture later in later life of Rowland Hazard. He is the one on your left. In the center is his wife, and on the right is his son, Peter. In the 1940s, what you're looking at here is, this is the wife in the center who was getting treated by Carl Jung. What happened between there? Roland wound up going to a guy named Courtney Baylor. Now, Courtney Baylor is a lay therapist, and he comes out of a place called the Emanuel Group, which is in Boston. And the Emanuel Group was started out, and there was a Jacoby House, which actually later on AA hooked up with. And they were actually doing some things that were very similar to what AA is doing in terms of one person helping out another. Courtney Baylor wrote a book called Remaking a Man, One Successful Method of Mental Refitting. And this was written in 1919. Bill Wilson also had read this book. There is evidence of that. And some of this is, and the source has, there's a lot in common with the Big Book itself, which sounds a lot more like the Big Book than what Carl Jung's, you know, sitting and talking about dreams was. This is one of the things it says in that book. It says, the instructor's aim is to bring about in a sick man, in a sick mind, permanent relaxation and re-education. To do this, he must develop intuition and resourcefulness. To teach a man to relax his body is one thing. To teach him to relax his mind is a much more difficult problem. Now, does that sound like an Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, that's the real deal, isn't it? This, to me, sounds more like the treatment for that we've come to know than talking about dreams. So right now, we know that in 1933, Roland Hazard started getting treated by Courtney Baylor. In 1934, he stopped drinking. And he got associated with a thing called the Oxford Group. Now, the Oxford Group was started by Frank Buckman. Frank Buckman was a minister who was working at a YMCA-like reform school, or it's actually, you know, a boarding school, and he had a dispute with the management over the food bill, and he copped the resentment, and he quit, and it was just tearing him up, and he went on a tour around, and he wound up in England, and when he was in England, he met, and he was going to one conference, and he was walking back from there, and there was a little thing going on at a church announcement, and a gal named Jessie Penn Lewis was doing a talk. Anybody ever hear of Jessie Penn Lewis? Well, Jessie Penn Lewis had four steps to getting rid of her resentment. One of them was surrender. Another one was to take a searching moral inventory. The third was restitution. And the fourth step was to give of yourself without expectation of anything in return. This became the core of the sixth step that was the Oxford Group, which later became the 12 steps of AA. And it was because he happened to go into a church and to a meeting he had no plan to go into. Throughout the history of AA, there are little God shots all around, little coincidences. And you think, what if he hadn't gone in there? So, does anybody recognize Lois Wilson? Let's get on to Bill. What's Bill doing at this time? Bill has gone, Bill is born in Vermont. He's grown up there, and he is a guy who wants to be number one at everything. Anything he tries out, he wants to be number one at. His mother and father divorce at an early age, which is very unusual at that time, and she goes off to study medicine. She actually becomes a doctor, and he is raised by his grandfather and grandmother. Now, he falls in love with a minister's daughter, and the minister's daughter goes to a minor operation, which is that time, minor operations, well, I know what minor operations are for me. Minor operations are operations on you. Major operations are the ones on me. But it turned out that minor operation, she died from it, and Bill went into a deep depression for several years. And shortly after, and about a year and a half later, he met Lois, who was vacationing with her family. Her dad was a doctor, and they lived down on Clinton Street in Brooklyn. And they were up there for their summer vacation. And Bill just and Lois hit it off very well. Lois is an amazing woman. She's wearing pants in the picture. Does anybody notice that? They love to hike. You're looking at what she's holding on to on that picture on the left. is a motorcycle. Bill got an idea by going and researching companies up and down the East Coast and bringing information back. Nobody in Wall Street had done that before, and they didn't want to fund it, so he just got a Harley Davidson with a sidecar, and they packed it. They had tents and everything in that, and Lois did most of the driving and the repairs. I don't know about the repairs, but Lois was quite an interesting character. And Lois was always hoping to fix Bill. And Bill would have these drinking bouts, but then she was able to get him out in the country. And when she could get him out in the country and hikes and everything, he'd stay sober. Get him back into town, get him around the house, get him bored a little bit. Anybody here ever been bored? We get restless, irritable, and discontent. I go back to my solution, right? So Lois is a very, and the thing about Lois for me is how she stood by Bill for so long. My wife has stood by me for so long. I think so many of us are so fortunate with the family members that we have that have been there with us. And I think that's one of the great debts of gratitude. I don't know, I can't explain it, but I'm a man very fortunate. My wife and I'll be celebrating 32 years of marriage here in October. I am very grateful. This is that car. This is the picture of this motorcycle with all the stuff packed on it. And let me tell you what, there weren't paved roads. These folks were going up. And you know what? This shows his seekers. One of the things we are in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, that really keeps us is the seeker. We were seeking something when we were drinking and using, right? We're always seeking. And that's what I think is beautiful about this program. Well, Bill's drinking gets so bad that he goes and winds up in town's hospital. And this is Dr. Silkworth, who wrote the doctor's opinion. Dr. Silkworth was a neurosurgeon, and he made what would make a reasonable decision. He invested in the very hospital he was working in. He just did it right before 1929. And when the stock market crash hit, Dr. Silkworth lost his shirt. He lost just about everything. And he wound up working for a guy named Charlie Towns in Towns Hospital. And Charlie Towns happens to be from Georgia, as it turns out. And Charlie Towns had come up with this wild idea about using belladonna and some other drugs to cure alcoholics. And it's very controversial about Charlie Towns' cures. So Bill first came in there, I believe, in 33, and that you can check the timeline on that. But he wound up going to Towns Hospital three different times. Now, Dr. Silkworth was a man who fell in love with the alcoholics. And he's the one who came up with the concept of an allergy, that we have an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. Now, this is very controversial among doctors because the immune system is where allergies occur, okay? And this is where HIV happens. So to say that we have an allergy, to a doctor, they'll go, no, it's not an allergy. But this is what an allergy, if we use our definition, is an abnormal reaction to a foreign substance. And that's the difference with me. When I take in drug alcohol, I become a different person. And I cannot make decisions for that guy on the other side of the drink as to what he's going to do. It took a lot of guts for Dr. Silkworth to make these statements and to come up with this, but he just saw it over and over again, that when the person took a drink, they changed. Just like if you got a bee sting, your body changed. You break out in hives. My sister wasn't allergic to poison ivy until somebody burned poison ivy in the backyard behind her house. And now she can't get around it or she breaks out. Well, see, poison ivy doesn't do anything for her. See, alcohol, for me, it takes me when I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, and I get just a little restless, just a little, and I take that drink and I go, ah, and I'm okay. But not quite okay, you see, because one more will be even more okay, right? And then I take the one more, and then it's off to the races. So that's the difference between her allergy and my allergy, is that alcohol is my solution. If I'm an alcoholic, alcohol is not my problem. alcohol is my solution. And it stops working because it's got lots of consequences. So, Ebby Thatcher. Ebby Thatcher was a school buddy of Bill, and they went to basically middle school, high school together. And Ebby had a father and a brother who were both mayors of Albany at different times. They had a big manufacturing plant, but Ebby was one of those characters and one of the drinking buddies. In fact, Ebby and Bill, one time they heard that there was going to be a little airport opening up in a small town, and they chartered a plane and told them they were going to be the first to land there. And they come land, and they land there, and they are poured out of the plane. They're just sloppy drunk. And the whole town's out there to greet them and open up this new airport. So that's the kind of guy Ebby was, you know. He was a party guy, you know. But Ebby kept getting more and more into trouble. And finally he gets over into this town of Vermont, and his family just says, you go take the town. He had gotten an inheritance from his dad when his dad passed away, and he went through it all. You know, lost some of it in the stock market crash, but he drank away the rest of it. Anybody else around here? I think the great name for me is user. You know, give it to me and it's just gone, right? Now, what I found out through this program is the world loves a giver. They'll give to a giver. And that's another thing that this teaches me. Because I can see that what happened was, and the shift with Ebby is this is how it worked. Ebby gets in trouble. First of all, he drives his car into a farmhouse where the lady's cooking there in the kitchen and finds out that she's okay and steps out. And as Bill says, asks for a cup of coffee. Who knows with Bill if that actually happened. But the car crash happens. But anyway, Ebby is in the town and he's painting his house, this house. And he gets to a certain point and he's as done as he can do. And now, he hadn't been drinking, but now it doesn't have anything to do, so he decides to drink. And according to one story, he's out there watching pigeons poop on his paint job. And he decides to get a gun out and start shooting at them inside the town. And the town took a very dim view of this. And this was about three strikes for Ebby. Well, in Vermont at that time, three strikes and you go into a mental asylum. And in a mental asylum at that time, it was pretty hard to get out. You couldn't just talk your way out of it. So what happened was there was two guys who had been drinking buddies with Ebby who were part of the Oxford group. And this is the Oxford group that Frank Buckman had formed, and it was basically a return taking these four steps that he learned from England, those four concepts that he had. And what he was going to do was get some rich people, you know, and build an organization that would then carry on this big movement. But he would do it instead of preaching to big groups. He didn't think that was a great idea. What he liked is the one-on-one. And so develop all these little groups of people talking one-on-one to help each other with their, to find spirituality. So Roland is connected in with these guys. And these two guys go to see Ebby before the paint job thing, and he begins to listen to them. So they hear that one of those boys is the son of the judge in the town. So he calls Roland, who is in a town about 20 miles south of there, and they come up for the court date. And Roland is there, and the judge is thankful because Roland has helped his son get sober. So the judge says, okay, I'll remand him into your care, but just get him out of town. So they take him down 20 miles south of there. And within 2 weeks, Ebby is going around the circuit in the area telling his story, you know, a speaker after 2 weeks. And later on, he goes down into New York City, into a place that is Samuel Shoemaker had that was, it's an Episcopal church there, and they had a place there for drunks to get sober. And it was basically mission. And Ebby's standing there doing dishes and everything, and he's thinking about somebody he can carry the message to, you know, to take the message to somebody else without any thought of anything return, and he thinks about Bill Wilson. Here's where we start getting into this. Bill Bouchard is the man who wrote the screenplay for My Name is Bill W. He's also somebody I've had a chance to meet a couple of times, and I met him again down in Macon. Now, Bill, for that book, he did an interview with Lois. And in that interview, we talk about the famous night when Ebby comes and sits around the kitchen table. Well, I have a recording of Ebby that says the kitchen table never happened. What Ebby says is he called up Lois the night before. Lois said, Bill's got to hear this. Come on over for dinner. He comes over for dinner. There's this black man who is has been sort of like the chauffeur and houseman for Lois's family. Remember, they're the doctors down in Clinton Street. They're living outside of there, but the black man is still there. And he opens up the door and invites Ebby in. A little bit later, Bill comes in carrying a couple of bottles, makes an excuse he needs to go get ice cream, and heads out. And Ebby says, I know what he was doing. You know, he wasn't going to share anything with me. You know, and so Lois comes home, according to Ebby, starts cooking dinner. Bill comes in later on. They have dinner, including the lady who's renting a room upstairs. They all have it, and then clean up the dishes and go upstairs to the parlor, because that's the way the brownstones are organized. And they're sitting around, and Lois says, okay, what's all this about, Ebby? And Ebby starts talking and doesn't finish up till 1 o'clock in the morning. That's Ebby's story. You know, and Ebby says, doesn't really make a difference. You know, because, you know, what happened was a message was carried. Something happened to Bill at that time. But it is real interesting for me is my past, as I remember it, probably didn't happen that way. And there's as many different views of history as there are people that were there. But the important and the essential and the funny thing about that I also learned from this is I was talking to Bill because when he's interviewing Lois, he gets to that point and I'm going, okay, good, I'll hear what Lois has to say about this. And Bill dictates to Lois what happened that day based on Bill's story and then asks another question about a succeeding day. And you can hear in Lois's tone, just in the background, that she wants to say something. And when I met with Bill, I said, Bill, what happened there? And he said, well, I'm a professional reporter, but on this thing I'm very passionate. And I said, I got carried away with it. So we still don't know from Lois what the real story was. But I'll tell you, Mel B., who wrote Pass It On, who was down in Macon, confirmed with me, as did Bill Bouchard, that Lois did get a call from Ebby the night before. So Ebby didn't just show up there at the door. What's all this have to do with it? It's just sort of the fun of AA, to get in, to explore, and to enjoy some of the nuances, I think, and also to meet these people who are the seekers. Well, Bill spends a week going up to the mission. Even one time he goes walking up, half drunk, gets up to the podium, starts preaching. You know, this is in between the time Ebby's message and Bill has his hot flash in Towns Hospital. And he's there with some fisherman, you know, and there's Ebby trying to keep him, you know, in line a little bit. And finally Bill goes, and about a week or so later, and he checks himself in. And if you look on this form there, you have to look kind of closely, but it says 12/11/34. That's the check-in date. And 12/18/34 is the checkout date. That is the time when Bill was at Towns Hospital. He read some of William James, the Varieties of Religious Experience, and he had his spiritual awakening during that time at Towns Hospital. And that part you can read in the big book. So when he comes out from there, he begins to get in with Dr. Sam Shoemaker, the reverend, who is part of the Oxford group. And he actually met Frank Buckman quite early on in Peking, Beijing, you know. And Frank Buckman was quite a traveler. He wound up spending quite a bit of time with Mahatma Gandhi. He was also a seeker. He was just going around looking for, you know, different ways about furthering the movement. But Sam Shoemaker is one I think is responsible for things like our current version of the St. Francis Prayer. This is just my own opinion, because there's a couple of different things. The Serenity Prayer is different than the original one that Frank Niebuhr wrote, if you ever want to look that up. There's just some nuances about it, but Sam Shoemaker is someone who Bill really credited with being his really spiritual advisor in the early days, in those first 6 months. So Bill's trying to get all these people sober, and Alois's family says, hey, Bill, you know, we think it's really cool that you're doing what you're doing with all these people, you know, but how about making some money? You know, Lois is sitting here working in a department store, and you're running around trying to save the world, you know? Doesn't it make sense that you kind of be self-supporting through your own contributions? So he goes down and sits back around Wall Street, you know, where he'd made his money. And he just hangs out there hoping that something will happen. Well, something does happen. They find out that there's a takeover bid for a little manufacturing company in Akron, Ohio. And they manufacture the machines that put the white walls and the labeling on the outside of tires. And there's a proxy bid, which means they've got shareholders and that there's a chance that they can take over this company and Bill would become president. So they go over to Akron, Ohio, and he stays at the Mayflower Hotel. And then they find out that there was some monkey business with the proxies. Bill can't prove it, but the other partners, they're fed up, they leave. And Bill's going to stay there and try and straighten it out. You know how we are? We're stubborn. Anybody around here stubborn just a little bit? So he's going to stay there, but he's got $10 in his wallet. Okay, now that's still in 1934 money, 1935 at the time. But it's, maybe $100, $150 or, more. But it's not enough for him to get back to New York. And he's down in the Mayflower Hotel, and he's looking in one direction. There's the bar. Maybe he can go down there and have a soda. Right. Meet somebody there that might help him out. And instead, he sees an old phone booth. And on the phone booth are the names of a number of ministers. So he happens to call one, Reverend Tunks. And the reason he calls Tunks is because Tunks is a Vermont word for taking a walk in the woods. That's the reason he called. And Tunks happens to be part of the Oxford group, which, by the way, is very big in Akron because Sam Firestone's son gets sober for a while in the Oxford group. And so the Firestones bring a bunch of people down. And they have the big, it's a big weekend, it's on the front pages, all this stuff about the Oxford group. Well, at that time, that's when Ann Smith started going to the Oxford group. And that was in 1931, she started going to the Oxford group. She has a journal from 1931 to 1939. And there's a very good case that a lot of what's in the big book is in that journal. And it is available online about that. But let's talk about Dr. Bob. What's been happening with Dr. Bob? Dr. Bob, when he meets Ann Smith, who has become his wife, they wind up courting for 17 years. And it's speculated that it's partly because of his drinking problem. But Dr. Bob has been trying to get sober through the Oxford group. He's been going to the meetings. And one of the things you're supposed to do in the Oxford group is you're supposed to confess what you've been doing, and then everybody will take your inventory and then tell you what you should do, and they'll also go off and ask for advice from God, hoping for divine inspiration. Well, Dr. Bob's not one to do this. He is a proctologist, and he cuts on some very sensitive areas, and I don't know about you, but I wouldn't be real eager to have a drunk working on that part of my body. So it's real reluctant to let anybody know that he cannot hold his liquor. So he's having to drink, and he's having to use sedatives and doing all this. He's a tweaker. Any tweakers here? He's got to do this to get just right for that. Then he's got to make it just long enough so he can get enough money so he can pay the bootlegger, because this is during Prohibition and all. So, but finally, Henrietta Seiberling, who you see here, is part of the Oxford group. She talks to the group and says, we know Bill's, that Bob's got a problem. Let's all really tell some of the really nasty stuff about ourselves in one meeting and see if it'll bring Bob out. So early in, late in April, maybe early in May, they have this meeting. And sure enough, Dr. Bob says, I have a real drinking problem. And so they all start praying for him. Henrietta starts praying for him. And Henrietta is a woman of great faith. You know what Henrietta is expecting? A miracle. Guess what happens on the 11th of May? She gets a call from a guy at the Mayflower Hotel who's looking for a drunk to fix. Henrietta Seiberling doesn't say, who the hell are you? She says, I've been waiting on your call. Now that's a neat part of the history. This happens. Now, Henrietta calls up on that Saturday before Mother's Day, and Dr. Bob is up in the bed, crashed out. Both his daughter and son have had to carry him up the steps. Bill says he's passed out underneath the piano, but the son, Bob Jr., Smitty, says, no, that's not what happened. He never did that. We always got him up the stairs, and he just passed out in bed. But the next morning, they wake up, and Smitty drives both Ann and Bill, and Dr. Bob, over to the Cyberling estate. And Dr. Bob says, I'm only going to give this guy about 15 minutes. And when they get there, they wind up talking 5 hours. And one of the first things Bill said to Dr. Bob was, looks like you could use a drink. Too bad, you know, Henrietta didn't have any in the house. But that started out the identification. And Dr. Bob said, this is the man who spoke my language. And he said, of all the things he knew about the spiritual angle. He knew he was going to need that. And he knew a lot about the medical side of alcohol. What he didn't realize was about carrying the message to another alcoholic would be the way to stay sober. Now, we celebrate, when was Dr. Bob's last drink? Anybody know? Yeah, do you know the actual date? But you know what? Historically, the conference was still going on June 10th. It may be that Dr. Bob's actual last drink was closer to the 15th, which is kind of interesting. We have this as set in stone, that June 10th is the day of Dr. Bob's last drink, and yet we go back and check the references, and they may have been off a little bit. So this is another case where we're not even sure when we got to, you know, when our founding day is. I mean, we have it. This is what we're going to say it is. But I think that's very interesting that it was just one of those little disputes you think should be something we'd be real certain of, right? So Ann Smith, Bill called her the mother of AA. And she really was a very spiritual woman. In this diary that she had a couple of things that were really interesting. I hope you get a chance to read it. One of them, she had 15 types of surrender. Surrender the tongue. Ooh, that was a good one. Surrender my rights. And I went, wait a minute, this is America. What do you mean surrender my rights? And what she meant was surrender my right to be upset. You know? And that's an amazing thing. It's like, I have a right to be upset. It's sort of like, I have a right to cut my leg off with a chainsaw. You know? Why would I want to do that? And today I learned that I don't have to do that. I can surrender that right. Another thing she said in there, which has been really meaningful to me, is feelings are the fruit, not the root of my faith. And what that means to me is, when I was drinking, I was acting on my feelings. You know, gotta go this way, gotta go over here. You know, I feel this way, I gotta go over that way. And I was always being ruled by my feelings. And what she's saying is that I should be ruled and take actions based on principles. And then at the end of the day, I reach up and I pluck the succulent fruit of a day well spent. I harvest my feelings. I don't act upon them. That's part of what the message from Ann was. So when Dr. Bob and Ann invited Bill to come live with them after this, and they began to go try and sober up drunks. And they did it at City Hospital in Akron. And then Bill went off back to New York to try and get some people sober. During this time, Akron, they're beginning to get groups come in, and I just want to mention this. Who has read Keys to the Kingdom? Okay? Great story, right? Sylvia Kay is the author of that. Sylvia was this debutante, and there's all these guys, you know, in AA. Now, they didn't have any problem with Sylvia, but the wives did. But Sylvia managed to go back, and I believe it's back to Chicago, and be a key starter of AA in Chicago. And but the keys to the kingdom, and she remained sober. She is one really who stayed sober from the time, you know, early on. So she actually came down, and they would bring people down from Chicago or from Detroit to come down to Akron and be with Bill and Lois, I mean Bill and with Dr. Bob and with Ann, and to get sober down there and then take the message back. There's many others along those lines. Who has heard of Hank Parker? Hank Parker is a very key player in the fact that we own the publishing rights to the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Hank Parker was a bigger sales and promotion guy than Bill Wilson was. And Hank was he had gotten fired from the Standard Oil Company as a regional sales manager because of his drinking. A gal named Ruth Hawk was a secretary who worked for him, and this little thing, and what they were going to do is create a co-op of gasoline stations that was going to beat out Standard Oil. He was going to take on Standard Oil, and from this little tiny office. But what we got from all of that was we got a secretary with not a lot to do who had time to type up a manuscript. And Hank Parker was the guy who said, he was one of the first ones in Towns Hospital where Bill would go back in and talk to the different drunks who were there that were Dr. Silkworth's patients. And he would talk to them, and Hank Parker was the first one that took the bait. And Hank really got on fire about this. Now, Hank said they went to a publisher, and this guy was willing to pay him $1,500 up front for just the two, based on just two chapters that they had. And Hank said, if it's worth that much, we publish ourselves. And he was a big thinker. And what we need to do is they went to the trustees, and they talked about forming a corporation, and the trustees said, I don't think so. So what they did is they went down to a shop, bought a pad of stock certificates, labeled it by hand, Works Publishing. By the way, it was immaterial that there wasn't actually a company. Okay, there was no charter, there was no lawyer involved, there was nothing written up, there was a pad of paper with stock, which is not the way you start a business and you sell stock. And he was going to sell these stocks for $25 each, which is a lot of money back then, to all these drunks. And from that, they were going to fund this Works Publishing. And from there, it would be the start of missionaries and, you know, hospitals and all this. By the way, I love the picture, the cover of the big first edition. They called it the circus cover. It's kind of hard to stay anonymous carrying around a book like that, don't you think? And you notice they call it the big book because they printed it on big paper and thick paper because they were charging $3.50 for this thing. $3.50 at that time was $35, $40, you know, a book. So it had to be big to make you think you were getting something. Now, Hank Parker wrote Two Employers. He's the author of that chapter. He also wrote one of the stories in the first edition. But Hank Parker got a resentment because he wanted royalties for being, you know, for help starting this book. And he eventually started drinking again. And he came back, and Bill settled up with him on a debt by having him giving him $250, and he signed away his rights to the big book for $250 so he could go out and get drunk. And you'll see in Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age, he'll be listed as Henry Parker. But if you want to read more about what Bill has to say about Henry, you can go there. The big book gets published, and these are the two magazines, the Liberty Magazine and the Saturday Evening Post. And the first one was actually one that Bill thought it would scare the people off because it was called Alcoholics and God. And he said, that's going to scare more alcoholics than it's going to attract them. That was in 1939, but the big one was in 1941 when Jack Alexander published the article in the Saturday Evening Post. And Jack Alexander was a headhunter. In terms of he would go out and he was the hatchet guy. He would go find out the real scoop about an organization, you know, and write it up, and then you'd find out the real deal about him. And he was actually sent in some ways. Some people say he was sent in there to find out the, you know, what was all bad about Alcoholics Anonymous. Instead, he found out an incredible organization unlike anything he'd seen, and he wrote about it, and I believe it actually came out, there was two issues? I know there was the one issue, definitely, but I have heard of a second one. What happens in Akron is that Dr. Bob is Central Hospital in Akron, not Central, but it's, what's the name of the one in Akron?
St. Thomas
Hospital in Akron. And St. Thomas, at St. Thomas is Sister Ignatia's there. Now, Sister Ignatia is born in Ireland and comes over here as a young girl. And becomes a nun, and she starts running a music program. And she said at one time, you know how stressful a music program can be, you know. But she had a nervous breakdown in trying to run this whole diocese music program. So she had an understanding of how the mind can affect you and how you can how it can become a negative impact on you. And she had, I guess, also a sympathy for the alcoholic. But she began to let Dr. Bob put patients into the hospital with excuses like gastritis, because they wouldn't admit an alcoholic into the hospital. A couple of reasons. They were very difficult when they were going through the DTs, crawling under the beds, running around the halls, disturbing the other patients. And the other thing is they didn't pay very well. So, but she was able to always sneak them into different places, into flower rooms and other places. And she began to gradually work out a process of having the other alcoholics who were sober sponsor the people that came in. And she worked out a plan that I'm going to have Bill come up I'm going to have Jim come on up and talk about a little bit about when he knew Sister Ignatia in Cleveland. She had essentially a lot of the same techniques that she used in Rosary Hall in Cleveland were developed there at St. Thomas. So what I'm going to do at this time is I'm going to ask Jim to come on up and talk about his experiences with Sister Ignatia and Rosary Hall. So.
Thank you, Damon, and good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Jim Doney, and I'm an alcoholic. I love you too, and I'm learning to love Icky Pa. I'm very glad that Damon asked me to be here this morning because I have enjoyed his presentation so much, and I might have missed it if he hadn't asked me to be here. I particularly identify with the various versions of history that we can have. My own and my family's recollection of my past. Believe it or not, common among other people outside the program, too. I now live in a retirement community down in Florida. Everybody's an old geezer there. And the local newspaper runs biographies of people. It's like a man on the street. It can be anybody. They haven't done anything exceptional. It's an introduction to the local residents. They pick somebody, I don't know how they even pick them, but they pick somebody and they print their biography in the paper once a week. I was recently at a dinner party, and the man whose biography was in this week's paper was at the party, and everybody was kidding him about all of the great things he had done. And his wife started to kid him a little bit and implied that all of the information he had given the reporter might not be quite as accurate as he would have you believe. He finally looked her right in the eye and he said, "Honey, it's my past and I reserve the right to remember it my way." So I'm going to have to do the same thing. Remember my past my way. Damon has asked me to recall something that happened 50 years ago at a time when I could barely remember my own name. And I already told you last night I flunked out of college. Now, if somebody had told me I was going to have to answer a quiz on Sister Ignatia 50 years later, I would have taken better notes, I guarantee you. But I can't tell you a lot about her. I was one of her acute gastritis patients, though. I checked into Rosary Hall on September 1st, 1960. And I was revolted by the sight of the black habit, as I told you last night. I wasn't exactly anti-Catholic, but I was anti-religious. And I learned to change my mind about that. I do remember that. There are a lot of stories about, well, to give you a brief description of what Rosary Hall looked like, it is a suite of rooms, really. There's a dormitory. There is one small room for women patients. There are women. At that time, only took two at a time. I don't know whether it must be bigger than that now. The men's dormitory was big enough for, I would guess, 12 or 15 men. There was a living room where there were comfortable chairs where people could visit you and you sit around and chatted. There was a dining room where we ate, a kitchen, and offices, a library, and a little chapel. So it's quite a little community there in a corner of the hospital. There's no radio, no television, no newspapers, no outside contact. There are no telephones, only in the office, and they're locked up. You can't get at them. And once you're in there, you get nothing but AA visits and AA visitors and AA literature. And that's all you get, and it's normally a 5-day course. And it really is detox is what it is, and some introduction to AA. They kept me 7 days. They will keep you a couple of extra days, depending upon how you respond. There were a lot of stories about Sister Ignatia and about how she handled patients. Some of the stories were that she was a tough old lady, that she could be a pretty wicked speaker, that she responded to people in kind. And if a patient was obstreperous, she was just as obstreperous right back at him. And the rumor was that she could outcuss the drunkenest truck driver in town. I don't believe any of those stories. They just could not possibly be true. I don't know who made them up or why they would make them up, but that was not Sister Ignatia. She was a quiet, unassuming woman who was totally dedicated to helping us alcoholics. She never talked about herself. She never claimed or accepted any acknowledgement relating to AA. She always said she was not a member. She was not part of it. She could not ever represent it in any way. And she steadfastly stuck to that rule. The most contact I had with her was after I got sober. I sponsored 4 different guys on the staff of the TV station where I worked. My boss got very interested in AA then and wanted the station to do a documentary. Doing a documentary on AA on television is very difficult. How do you show people who won't, have to be anonymous? You can disguise their voices somewhat. You can shoot them in silhouette. You can maintain the tradition of anonymity, but it makes lousy television, frankly. And we just didn't know how to handle it. Somebody said, well, if we had one live person that we could show on camera who could represent AA, and she was obviously the choice. So I went to her several times and tried to convince her to do that program, and she absolutely refused. She would not do it. She was given a medal by President Kennedy. She accepted it on behalf of her order. I think the Sisters of St. Augustine was the order, and the Catholic Church, but not AA. And of course, the medal was for her work in AA. But she would not accept that or acknowledge that. She kept herself separate from AA because she was not a member. And she thought AA was the exclusive property of those who were in it. When she first started, I know she was criticized for some of the things that she wanted established at Rosary Hall, that she had the ideas she brought up from Serenity Hall at St. Thomas. Rosary Hall is in St. Vincent Charity Hospital in Cleveland. And she wanted a coffee urn on all the time in the kitchen. And the hospital didn't want to do that because that cost money, and they accused her of mollycoddling these drunks. And she said, of course I'm mollycoddling them. Of course, I'm taking care of sick people. You're supposed to mollycoddle sick people. You see, in those days, people thought of drunks as bad people who did bad things. And Sister Ignatia never thought of us that way. She thought of us as good people with a bad disease. We were sick, but we were good people. And she treated people like they were good people. She didn't have to outcuss anybody or wrestle them for attention. Sister Ignatia could walk into the room and with her quiet manner, with her smile, with a touch of her hand, she could calm the most obstreperous drunk. And I saw her do that many times. I don't know exactly how to describe her. One way I can tell you a story. It isn't about Sister Ignatia, but it could be. I'll put it that way. When I lived in Hawaii, the senator from Hawaii, Dan Inouye, you'll hear it pronounced Inouye by the network news guys. They're mistaken. It's Inouye. Anyway, Dan Inouye, I think he's the longest serving senator now in the Senate. He's been the senator from Hawaii or a congressman since World War II. He was a World War II hero. He lost his arm in a battle in Italy. He was of the 442nd Division. He's a fine American of Japanese ancestry and a great man, I think, and a great senator. And he spoke in Honolulu on public service. And I was the public service director at the TV station. That was one of my several titles. And so I went to that luncheon, and he told this story because he objected, in a way, to calling politicians public servants. He said, you know, we all claim to be public servants, but we're not. We're representatives, but we're not your servant. And he said, I will give you an example of a true public servant. And he told this story of a millionaire sitting in a hospital waiting for something for a long period of time, and he saw a nun who was working as a nurse's aide walk by with a mop and a bucket. And she came back a few minutes later with her habit wet and soaked. Obviously, she'd been mopping a floor somewhere. A few minutes later, he saw her walk by carrying a huge container full of bloody bandages, which she disposed of somewhere, and came back wiping her hands with a paper towel as she walked by him. The next time she came by, she was carrying a bedpan and brushing at her habit. Obviously, someone had vomited on her. And she was going with the bedpan to a closet, to a room. And the millionaire stopped her and he said, "Sister, I wouldn't do what you do for $1 million. And she looked him in the eye and said, "Neither would I." That was Sister Ignatia. That could have been her. What she did, you wouldn't do for $1 million, and neither would she, but she'd do it for you. I wanted to get out of there several times. They kept telling me she wasn't there. When I did check out, she admitted she was there. She'd been there all the time. She knew what I wanted, and she hid in the chapel and said, "You know, I knew you'd never look for me in there because I wouldn't stick my nose in the chapel." But I sat down with her before I left, and she gave me the Sacred Heart, which was her custom. You had to bring it back to her before you took a drink. And she gave me a little booklet, which I still have. And it's called Confidence in God. And that has developed over the years, too, and become true, as did everything else that she told me. And she wrote something in that book before she handed it to me. I didn't read it at the time. I read it later. And I was very surprised at what it said. I thought I could predict what it might have said. Can you predict what she would have written to a guy who was coming out of Rosary Hall and going down the first, taking his first step down the path at AA? I thought she would have written, "I'll be praying for you," or something like that. Sister Ignatia wrote, "Pray for me." I still have that. And I still pray for her. If they don't make her a saint, us Protestants will.
I think what Jim's talk means a lot to me is to savor each and every person you're with right here at this conference. Because we're in history right now. Just like Jim said, if he should have known he was supposed to take notes. You see, if I'm so busy trying to become something, to get somewhere, that then I'll be happy, get everything just right, then I'll be okay. And I'm still in my disease. If I can savor each and every one of you, right here, right now, I can be fully present, right here, right now, we all win. You know, so much has to do with marveling in the ordinary. There's some stuff going on around you that seems very ordinary. But we don't know that what kind of miracle that's the start of. And that's what I find, to savor every moment that we're in. And history teaches me that. Each one of these people, what they were doing just seemed their everyday stuff, just what they were doing just to get by. And what they were doing was building a legacy for a future, and they didn't know it. I'm going to, a couple of things here. Did anyone get to San Antonio? Awesome, wasn't it? I'll tell you what, that was being a part of history. And what I liked is how many young people were there at the conference. There was a lot of energy there. I was able to go there with my son, who's now got 4 years in the program. I got to be in that room that you see pictured there with all of those people. And that's 50,000 alcoholics. There are 2 million sober alcoholics in the world today. That's just a very small percentage of those who need to be here. I want to say one other thing. I went to IKIPA in July of 2009. And I heard, then I saw the energy, and I saw the vitality that was here, and I saw it again last night. And Sunday morning, the Class A trustee, who's chairman of the board of Alcoholics Anonymous, a Class A means the non-alcoholic, stood there and talked to the crowd, and he said, "I've seen the future of AA, and I like it." Last night, I saw the future of AA here in Georgia, and I like it. Amen. There are ripples upon ripples going out from this one thing today that will be the start of lots of sobriety. Things have happened this weekend that we have no clue where they're going to ripple to. That's the lesson of history. It's the little things we do. It's all the little things we do right. Little right choices. I read a book called The Slight Edge. And what it said was, the slight edge is it's very easy to go exercise in the morning. It's very easy to get up in the morning and do your prayers. The real kicker is, it's easy not to. And those little things build up over time. Doing the little right thing, it's like putting money in the checkbook. Doing the little wrong thing, it's like swiping the credit card. It doesn't seem like much, but after a while, that credit card builds up and builds up and builds up and then seems to be so overwhelming you can't do anything about it. So today, each and every one of us has a choice, and we can do the next right thing. And how am I going to know what the next right thing is? By learning from the successes of others. We have a roadmap, and I think the one way is to know what happened in the past. And help us see what we can do today that's got a good chance of working. I want to finish with this slide. 2015 Atlanta, folks. I don't know about you, but I plan on being there, and I plan on being there sober. Thank you for letting me share.
Yeah.